This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The student population in Vermont is trending decidedly downward. Since peaking at about 107,000 students in 1997, the number of students in the Green Mountain State has fallen to about 88,000. But it's been pointed out that the number of teachers and staff in the state remains about the same. While some small schools have closed over the last few years, many are still operating with fewer and fewer students. High property tax rates are a perennial source of friction, but in the last year, Vermont's Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb has raised questions beyond the cost to taxpayers for maintaining smaller schools. She's concerned about the quality of education in the schools with the fewest students. All this week, VPR News is looking at the challenges of rural education in Vermont in a series we're calling Declining Enrollment. Today, Vermont Edition is going to look at the approach some of our New England neighbors have taken to the same issue. We'll learn about Maine's attempt at district consolidation and at how New Hampshire uses a different model to fund its schools. First, though, we're going to get an update on where Vermont's district consolidation bill stands. Josh O'Gorman is a reporter for the Vermont Press Bureau, which serves the Rutland Herald and the Barrie Montpelier Times Argus. And he joins us from VPR's Montpelier studio. Josh, nice to have you with us.
Hey, Jane. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So the House passed this education bill on Thursday of last week. Now it goes to the Senate. So let's talk through some of the major provisions in the bill as it stands right now. For one thing, it would create a path for education districts to be set up. And there's a minimum, a number of students set at 1,100. That's the minimum number for each of these education districts. What is that supposed to achieve, Josh?
Well, the notion, I believe, is that, one, it's going to cut down on administrative overhead, be it for superintendents or be for financial managers or special education directors. It's also going to help smaller school districts save money in those costs that you have to pay per district. You know, whether you have a school district of 2,500 students or 25 students, each of those school districts has to perform an annual audit in order to receive federal money. And so that audit is a fixed price. And so the notion is, you know, that's one of the many things that you'll be able to save money on should you collect these smaller school districts into larger operating districts.
But not absolutely every district or every school in Vermont is going to be able to become a part of one of these education districts. And that is accounted for in the bill.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some districts that already meet the criteria. For example, many of the school districts up in the Burlington area or Rutland City Public Schools, they already offer the K through 12 education with at least 1,100 students. There's also going to be exemptions for districts that are deemed geographically isolated, either due to there's a town on the other side of this mountain, but there's no pass that's open during the winter, so you can't really take a bus over it. You know, so there's going to be provisions for those sorts of issues, but in general, they are looking at the year 2019 to have these larger districts in place.
What do towns that join these districts actually get out of the deal?
Well, hopefully what they are going to be getting out of it, I guess, is some, as the parlance of the State House is this semester on this subject, bending the cost curve. As we know, cost of education has risen approximately 115% in the last 10 years, from about $7,700 per pupil to about $16,800 per pupil. And this cost is going up and up and up. And so the Joint Fiscal Office is proposing that this school district merger bill is going to save something on the order of $32 to $34 million. And so any savings that happens at all is going to be a move in a different direction, which has been continually upward in terms of spending.
And the state is trying to offer a tax incentive, right? I mean, there is a reduction in the statewide tax rate for these towns that go into these districts.
Yes, absolutely. There are certainly financial incentives for those, especially the ones that are going to do it voluntarily. So the bill calls on school districts or specifically communities to engage in these studies to look at the feasibility of merging with their neighbors, although not necessarily their neighbors. It's quite clear in the bill that the school districts do not have to be geographically contiguous in order to merge with each other. So, example, you could see a number of non-operating districts all come together. And so should these communities go ahead and have a vote of the people that is then approved by the State Board of Education, then there will be financial impact for them, a positive financial impact for those folks.
So beyond the consolidation, the district consolidation plans that are included in this bill, can you talk a little bit about the kinds of checks that are being put on how much towns are allowed to spend on education?
Sure. The common narrative coming out of the elections in November is that Vermonters are tired of how much they're paying in property taxes. And this isn't a new thing. However, this is what candidates who were campaigning and elected or not elected, I suppose, were saying as they were knocking from door to door, that the property taxes are just too darn high. In 2005, the education fund here in Vermont was supported about 61% with property taxes. And today it's about 68%. So in addition to the cost of education going up, we're also leaning on property taxes a lot heavier than we used to. And so one of the proposals that initially came out was just a simple 2% cap, that education spending cannot go up by more than 2%. And so if a school board were to bring a budget with more than 2% to the voters, that would be considered automatically failed. Not that you can imagine any school board would actually do that, except maybe out of some sort of protest. Folks felt that 2% cap was a little too draconian, maybe a little too arbitrary. And so they came up with this compromise that was proposed by Representative Sarah Buxton, a Democrat out of Tunbridge. And what she proposed is taking a look at next year's rate of increase. And if that matches this year's rate of increase, which across the state was 2.95%, if that stays the same, then everything is good. If next year, in 2016, the average school budgets go up by more than that figure, then in 2017 and in 2018, there are going to be caps imposed. And it's going to be a 2% cap, but it's going to be variable. So a school district would have the option of either applying that 2% on your per pupil cost or on your education spending. And not to get too wonky, but basically if your school district is expanding in size, if you're adding students, then you would want to go with one way. And if your district is doing what a lot of districts are doing is shrinking, you would go the other direction. And this would give the school districts some flexibility while still controlling some costs.
Got it. Go ahead.
So that's it. That's what I got on that. I don't want to go too terribly deep on that, I suppose.
You know, Josh, one of the things that we often hear from towns when they see the legislature starting to suggest that there should be caps on how much they can spend is that they say, well, but then we get these unfunded mandates that come down from Montpelier, and we have to find a way to fund them. So there's actually a provision for that in this bill as well.
Absolutely. Representative Patty Comline, a Republican out of Dorset, and I believe others, please, representatives might be listening, I forget who else is on there, but Patty Comline's amendment, which was adopted last week during the two-day debate on this bill, what that looks at is any education bill that is passed and approved by the legislature, the Joint Fiscal Office has to take a look at that and find out what the financial implications are of that. And whatever the costs are, it would require a transfer for that sum of money from the general fund to the education fund. So in effect, there would not be unfunded mandates. The mandates would be funded through the general fund. However, it is interesting to note that that provision does not apply to anything within the current education bill. So, for example, any of the merger studies that need to be conducted, it doesn't require a transfer of funds from the general fund to the education fund to cover that.
From what you've been able to gather from the mood in the State House, Josh, are House members pretty happy with this bill, or do they feel like it was a hold your nose and vote yes kind of compromise?
I don't know as there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. I wouldn't say that. I would say there's certainly more than there was last year. Last year's last year's school district consolidation bill came pretty late in the session. I believe it was like mid-April when it finally got passed by the House, and it died a quiet death over in the Senate Committee on Rules because it wasn't taken up. So this year there's more, I guess, of an imperative to do something. Representative Heidi Sherman out of Stowe would say that this is just doing something for the sake of saying that you've done something. She complains that this doesn't really do anything to actually fundamentally overhaul our funding system, and so therefore it's not going to work. However, there certainly wasn't the opposition this year that there was last year, I would say. There's a number of amendments that people proposed, including scrapping the bill altogether. There were proposals to eliminate the cap. But I would say that there was more enthusiasm for it this year than there was last year. But I don't know if that's saying a lot.
Josh O'Gorman is a reporter for the Vermont Press Bureau, serving the Rutland Herald and the Barrie Montpelier Times Argus. Thank you so much for talking with us, Josh.
Hey, Jane. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been getting a recap of efforts to overhaul school governance in Vermont. But what can Vermont learn from other states? Mandatory school district consolidation is an experiment that Maine has been trying for 6 years with mixed results. We're going to learn more about that just ahead. And listeners, if you have a question about other approaches to rural education, small schools, and declining enrollment, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, as part of the VPR News series Declining Enrollment, we're contrasting Vermont's issues and approaches to rural education with some of our neighbors. You can weigh in with your thoughts at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. Now that we've gotten the update on the latest legislative maneuvering around school funding and school consolidation in Vermont, let's find out how Maine does it. Maine is a larger state, both geographically and in terms of population. While Vermont has about 88,000 students, Maine has about 186,000. And they're spread out over a rural landmass nearly four times as large as Vermont. But Maine faces similar problems with declining enrollment, small schools, and lots of districts. Gillian Graham is a reporter for the Portland Press-Herald in Maine, and she joins us now from Portland. Gillian, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, as we mentioned, Vermont is in the process now of passing legislation that would create education districts of about 1,100 students or more. And as I understand it, in 2007, Maine passed legislation to set a minimum enrollment for school districts, although that number was set at 2,500 students. And that was also in an attempt to reduce the state's districts. How was it received in Maine?
The idea of consolidating districts in Maine was controversial right from the start. There was a lot of resistance to being forced to make big units and lose local control. But they did implement it, and we've seen very mixed results here, with not as many districts, consolidated districts, as the state government had hoped. But and then some very controversial kind of divorces between districts that had been in place for 3 years that then decided it really wasn't working for them.
So the bill had originally intended for Maine's 290 districts to go down to 80. How many districts are there actually now in Maine?
In 2009, when the law went into effect and these districts had to consolidate into regional school units, we reduced the number of units from 290 to around 164. And we are still at around that level, although there have been, in the past couple years, there have been about 30 communities that have pulled out of districts and either now operate on their own or have joined other consolidated units.
So it never actually got down to what the legislature was hoping it would by
That's
any
right.
stretch. And is that okay? I mean, is Maine fairly happy with the number of districts you have? Is it working out all right?
State education officials seem happy with where they are now. They are quick to point out that for the vast majority of the districts that consolidated, it's been a good thing. They've been able to reduce system administration costs while expanding opportunities, particularly with programs like all-day kindergarten or gifted and talented programs that they had struggled with before, especially in rural areas.
Gillian, there were some districts that were never able to merge under this plan. I mean, you've mentioned that some have gotten divorced, and I'll ask you about that in just a minute. But in terms of districts that just either couldn't find partners or were unable to find a merger, maybe you could describe one of those. I understand you actually live in one of those districts.
Yeah, so the towns that I grew up in, down on the southern coast of Maine, Wells and Ogunquit, they were never able to find, they were already a consolidated district with just the two towns, but they weren't able to find a district to join in with because the towns around them were either exempt from having to consolidate or had other partners or just didn't work. So they were never forced to make a merger with anybody despite their attempts to try. And there had been some fear from these districts that needed to consolidate that they would lose thousands in state funding if they didn't make the switch. But ultimately, the state suspended those that penalty and then repealed them a few years later. So there really was nothing that happened to the districts that couldn't consolidate.
You mentioned that some districts are having sort of messy divorces now that did consolidate in the first place. Is that because those penalties were revoked and they see no reason to be consolidated, or for other reasons?
That was part of it. In one of the areas that I cover is a city named Saco, and they had consolidated into a regional school unit with two towns, Dayton and Old Orchard, that were much smaller. And Saco officials right from the start said, we didn't want to consolidate. We only did because of the threat of penalties. So that was an argument that kept coming up as they decided ultimately to leave their consolidated unit. But the real issue for most towns that ultimately kind of got a divorce from their consolidated unit was local control. And it was very hard for some of these towns to give up control of their school budget and just kind of general decisions about the future of their students.
One of the things that Vermont is trying to do here with our plan, as it's moving through the legislature to consolidate districts, is to create cost savings, because these larger districts should be able to share costs that right now the argument is these smaller schools are just bearing on their own. In Maine, did the consolidation plan actually save taxpayers any money?
In some cases, maybe a tiny bit. We did an analysis last year looking at the first 4 years of consolidation, and we found that system administration costs per pupil dropped an average of about 12% in those first 4 years. And that compares to about a 3% reduction in those costs in districts that that didn't consolidate. But any savings from that was very rarely passed on to taxpayers. This was coming at a time when state education funding was being cut and just other costs were increasing. So those savings often were used to pay for other programs or cover other costs in the district, and were very rarely passed on to taxpayers.
So are taxpayers making any bones about that at this point, or are they just living with it?
You know, I think they're kind of living with it. One of the things that happened at the same time as consolidation is that when the school budget process at the very end of it now, we have budget validation referendums, so it's a townwide vote on the school budget. And in certain communities, you'll see that once the school board has passed a budget and puts it out to voters, that voters will reject it, sometimes even over and over, until they come back with a proposal that the taxpayers can kind of handle. So that's, in some communities, you'll see there's taxpayers who are very upset about education funding, but by and large, it seems people seem to be okay with it.
Did any small schools close as a result of this plan?
To my knowledge, not directly. Actually, part of the legislation was that schools couldn't close directly because of the consolidation unless the town gave the okay to do that. So in most cases, the only real changes in districts were at the top administration level, and not necessarily things that kids in the school would notice, except for maybe the addition of a program or better computers, things like that.
So in that sense, then, is Maine actually seeing any changes that they could attribute to this consolidation in terms of student performance or enhanced educational opportunities?
Certainly, there are superintendents and state officials who will say that they have seen improvements in opportunities for students, especially in rural areas where a school may not previously have had access to something like a gifted and talented program, but as part of a consolidated district, they can share a gifted and talented teacher across the district. So you hear about things like that, but you know, generally when we look at test scores and student performance here, people don't seem to be making the connection between how students are doing and what was happening in the administration of the schools.
Gillian, can you just go over a little bit, since I know funding formulas are very complicated. They certainly are here, and I think they are everywhere, but how school budgets are actually created and approved in Maine and in these consolidated districts?
So here, the school budget process starts at the local level with the school board. In a standalone district, it would just be their local school board, or in a consolidated district with a district-wide school board, and they develop a budget based on what the superintendent and school officials are requesting. And that budget that's approved by the school board now goes to voters for budget validation referendums. And previously, It would have been usually a, you know, town or city council or a board of selectmen that would have approved that. So that was the big change in terms of having giving taxpayers the final say.
So as we move forward right now, is Maine considering any new changes to either the funding formula or the consolidation plans?
There hasn't been talk of changing the consolidation plans at the state level. Certainly, there are always communities that are kind of shifting, joining another one or leaving. And then in individual districts, there have been the idea of the funding formula comes up frequently, especially in these districts where their mayor is just kind of on the rocks, and they'll make adjustments to their funding formula if, say, one community doesn't feels that they're paying too much of their the local responsibility for education costs.
That's Gillian Graham. She's a reporter for the Portland Press-Herald in Maine. Gillian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today, as part of the VPR News series, Declining Enrollment, we're looking at how Vermont's challenges with small rural schools compare to some of our New England neighbors. If you want to weigh in on what you see working in surrounding states, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts at vpr.net. We got a note from Tom who says, I would encourage your listeners to review the annual report that the NEA puts out comparing state-by-state expenses. It is eye-opening to see the amount we in Vermont spend on education. The per-pupil expenses and the average attendance compared to fall enrollments is staggering. And by the way, we do have a link to that report on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, so now we've spent some time learning about Maine's model. Let's turn to New Hampshire. Sam Evans-Brown is the education reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio. He's with us now. Hi, Sam.
Hey there, Jane.
So in 1997, some people may remember that both New Hampshire and Vermont had state Supreme Court cases on the inequity of education funding. And in both states, the courts ruled for the plaintiffs that funding education through local taxes was fundamentally unfair because rich towns had great schools and poor towns had not so great schools. So Vermont passed Act 60, and we're still using Act 60 and Act 68 as the basis for our school funding formulas. What did New Hampshire do?
Well, New Hampshire immediately engaged in sort of years of haggling and sort of politicking to try to figure out exactly how to come up with a solution that sort of maintained the status quo as much as possible. There was a coalition of wealthier communities that came together and came up with this term. They call themselves the donor towns, and they said that they would be forced to fund the education around the state, and called this unfair, and they became quite a political force. And the compromise that we came up with is something called adequacy. So now what happens is there's a statewide property tax that has been created, and that funds about $3,200 per pupil that goes to the state and is then redistributed back to the local district level. But, you know, local education on average costs $13,000 per student. So the state adequacy dollars, as we call them, really are less than a quarter of the amount that it takes to educate a child in New Hampshire.
So and that idea of adequacy aid, that's because the Supreme Court ruling said that the state must provide an adequate education. And so that's where that language actually comes from.
Right. So that's where the term comes from. And then how do you determine, this is what the fight has been in education funding in New Hampshire over the last, you know, really almost two decades now. How do you define how much it costs to fund an adequate education? And where we, you know, the formula we've arrived at now, it basically starts by looking at some of the biggest schools in the state, what they're spending per pupil, exempting things like the cost of the building and you know, the cost of certain staff, and then you extrapolate out from their per pupil number, this adequacy number, you know, how much does it actually cost to provide that core education?
But nobody's spending that much. So why aren't towns up in arms about the fact that they've got to basically fund three quarters of the education of their students?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think there are a lot of towns that are not 100% thrilled with the adequacy formula as it stands, but it's a moving target, I think, is kind of the answer. So the last time the adequacy formula was tweaked was 2011, and then not long after that, there was a second change that put a cap on the growth of how much the state would send to an individual town. And so it seems like every time towns start to grapple with the formula as it exists right now, some change is made so that they have to sort of recalibrate, think about it again, and so that they haven't really had a chance to form a coalition that would bring a lawsuit.
And in terms of how schools are doing under this formula, are the towns that have a lower grand list, that have less money to put into education, finding that their students or their per pupil spending is lower and the wealthier towns' per pupil spending is higher or not?
It's almost certainly the case. So the in the Claremont ruling, they were looking at a 5-to-1 ratio of what the difference between the local tax rate is in you know, these Claremont. So the Claremont towns were some of the poorer school districts that had to have a very high tax rate in order to fund their local education, versus some of the wealthier towns had a very low tax rate because their property tax base was so much broader and wealthier, they had to, you know, levy a smaller tax. And so there was a lot of focus in that court case on the fact that there was this 5-to-1 ratio between the poor towns and the richer towns. And I've got a spreadsheet here right in front of me of this year's tax rates. And you've got I'm going to go through the A's here. So in Albany, the local education tax rate is 660. And then the next one down, Allenstown, is 1620. And then, you know, next up, Alton, 586. So $5.86 per, you know, $1,000 of assessed valuation. A lot of people, you know, are saying that we're pretty close to that 5-to-1 ratio right now.
Right. So do you see another Supreme Court case coming up?
I think that, again, towns are just looking at the fight of the day. I mean, yeah. they aren't able to look out that far in the future because they're so engaged in advocating for changes to the current formula, as opposed to thinking, we should just give up on the legislative venue and just take the state to court. Right now, the issue is during the sort of recession years, they put a cap on how much your year-to-year adequacy could increase. That, you know, only 108% of the previous year could you get. And so a lot of the towns that are growing more quickly and are seeing their adequacy dollars curtailed because of that cap have been very engaged in trying to get the cap lifted over the past 2 years. There's a piece of legislation that would do that that's now gotten wrapped up into the state budget process. And really, I'm not sure where it's at this point. We've seen three different versions. One of them's been tabled. Another has been wrapped into the House of Representatives budget. And I think we're going to have to see what the Senate proposes in order to know what's going to come out of that process. But I think the short answer is they're not going to sue until they've exhausted their legislative options.
All right. So towns may be going in that direction. And as you said, maybe just trying to deal with what they've got on their plates. But for parents and for students, there are in some cases options for them. Can you talk a little bit about the charter school system in New Hampshire? And for parents who maybe want to find diverse offerings for their students, can they find them in the charter schools?
Right. So here in New Hampshire, we've got a little over 20 charter schools, and most of them are very small, very localized. The biggest one, I think, is just a little over 400 kids down in Nashua. But there's also an online charter school, which is actually one of the most successful in the nation. And they're just a local nonprofit. They were founded here in New Hampshire. They buy their courses from the Florida Online Charter School, which is been recognized as the most successful in the nation. And then they work through the local schools and they say, you can offer classes through us that you don't have the bandwidth to offer, or you can, if you have students who, you know, just can't fit into the typical public school schedule, they can become full-time students through us. And it's a part, besides Florida, it's the most attended, you know, as a percentage of the students in the state, the most number of students take classes in this, through this online charter school. Is the second most attended in the country, is what I'm trying to say.
So the online charter school in New Hampshire is the second most attended charter school system in the country?
Yeah, in terms of the ratio of public school students to the number of public school students who are taking a class through that online charter school, we're doing, you know, it's the second most popular.
Got it. All right. So what about consolidation? You know, we've been looking at district consolidation in Vermont, and we were just talking about the district consolidation that's been going on in Maine. Has New Hampshire attempted to make schools or districts consolidate?
Yeah, so school consolidation back in sort of the 80s and 90s, we had a school building aid that was used as an incentive to consolidate districts. And basically, you know, the baseline for if you wanted to build a new school, the state would pitch in 30% of your project. But if you were a cooperative district, the baseline became 40%. And then for every additional town you tacked into your cooperative district, it added another 5%, up to 55% of the project if you were in a co-op. And so, you know, you see a number of fairly large cooperative districts in New Hampshire. You know, we've got districts that have 8 towns, 5 town districts are fairly common. But that really has leveled off in recent years because school building aid was frozen again during the recession years, in part just because the budget was tight, but also in part because we saw sort of a boom in the number of towns that were building new schools because there was this money around in order to help it get done. So even as student populations were declining, the amount of money spent on new construction was rising, and the legislature said we've got to nip this in the bud.
So are you seeing some of the divorcing that we talked about with Gillian earlier happening in New Hampshire as well?
Yeah. So there are some towns that, you know, that have been sort of deconsolidating, you know, Hill and Franklin, Croydon and Newport, or looking at deconsolidating. Some of them have, some of them are just looking at it still. And it's really just local politics that is driving that. You know, one town is not happy with their tax rate, one town is not happy with some decisions being made by the school board, and so it's really very small town politics that are driving those decisions.
Sam Evans-Brown is education reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio. Sam, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
All right, go to vpr.net for all of the stories in our series, Declining Enrollment, about the challenges facing Vermont's small schools. That series is airing all this week on VPR News. Coming up, we're going to check in with former Human Services Secretary Doug Racine. He's been working with AHS secretaries in other states, and he says some of the problems Vermont has seen in the Department for Children and Families are echoed around the country. You'll hear more coming up next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Doug Racine spent more than 30 years in state government as a state senator, as lieutenant governor, and most recently as the secretary of the Agency of Human Services. Governor Peter Shumlin removed Racine from that position last summer, but he has continued to work in state government, just not in his state. He's got a contract with the American Public Human Services Association in Washington, D.C., and Racine reaches out to newly appointed human services secretaries and leaders in other states to help them navigate the challenges of running a large government agency. Doug Racine joins us now to talk about that work and what he's seen about how Vermont is tackling child protection as he's been watching from the sidelines. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Jane.
So in reaching out to these officials in other states who have just taken on this large role heading up what, at least in Vermont, is the largest agency in state government, what do you talk to them about other than trying to get them on board with your organization?
Well, that's my job, to get them interested in the organization and show them how the organization can help them. The organization, the American Public Human Services Association, was very helpful to me in my job, particularly when I was new and working my way through some of the management and organizational issues as well as the policy issues. What I'm finding is they're grappling with pretty much the same issues in their states that we have been in Vermont. Child protection is certainly an issue. There have been major tragedies in many of these other states. It's not unusual to see these things happen. But they're also struggling with their various management issues. They're looking for better ways to provide services to families, much as we have been doing here in Vermont for a number of years, trying to better integrate services around families to help families be stronger and better protect their children. They all have computer IT, information technology issues that they're struggling with. Some have been running their own exchanges. Some have not. But most of them are dealing with that, with very old computer systems, just as we are here in Vermont. And they're trying to modernize their systems as well. And then they're dealing with the issues like budget issues and increasing poverty and homelessness. Vermont is not an island. Vermont is very much a part of the national scene. And I'm finding these folks are, most are new to government, and they're trying to figure out how they can be effective in dealing with the issues that we're facing throughout the country.
So what do you tell them on that score? I mean, if they're new to government and suddenly reeling with all of these challenges and they're trying to run this huge agency, how do you help?
I start by talking about defining where they want to go. What happens to most new we call them CEOs, for lack of a better term, because they're secretaries, they're commissioners, they're directors and all of that. But they start off usually in January and February. They're in the middle of a legislative session. They're dealing with the crises of the moment and the budget issues. And most of them wait until after the legislative session to catch their breath. And that's when I think I and others in the organization can be most helpful. Define where you want your organization to go. If all you're trying to do is keep your head above water and dealing with the crises of the day, whether they're internal or external, you never figure out where you want to go. So define what you want your organization to look like. For me here in Vermont, it really was about integrating services. We deliver services in very siloed ways. That's not unusual. But we have a structure in Vermont that is different from most states, and that we have an agency that encompasses six departments. Most states, they struggle with that because the what would be in Vermont's Agency of Human Services might be divided up in two, three, even a half dozen different agencies and departments of state government. So they're really working at trying to get out of just service delivery in a silo and move to building plans around families so you can help them get ahead. Very similar to what I talked about when I was secretary, which was changing the name of the agency from the Agency of Human Services, which are means to an end, to the Agency of Human Development, helping people get ahead. And that's something that I would hope that the legislature would focus on. I know the agency is continuing to work on that, to try to get better outcomes for people and provide more assistance, particularly for children.
So when you, you're just starting to work with these leaders in other states, but do you have anecdotes from your own tenure that you rely on that you think either I did that great or here's a lesson, here's what not to do?
Well, I tell them they need to be aware of all the various constituencies and stakeholders around them. It's not only your staff and the people who are working for you. Obviously, it's the governor's office, which has a lot to say about people and their jobs. Has to do with the legislature, the various community partners that in human services every state works with. It's about advocacy groups. It's about the media and really focusing on your relationships. One I talked to said that that was her top priority, was to rebuild relationships because the department she's heading had developed a bad reputation and people weren't very confident in the work that they were doing. And this commissioner is saying, you know, this is the work we have to do and I want people to have confidence. So it's about relationship building too.
Talking with Doug Racine, he's the former secretary of the Agency of Human Services. And Doug, I know that you've been watching a bill that's been moving through the legislature here in Vermont about child protection. It's passed the Senate. It's now moving through the House. What's your view on it?
My view is they're dealing with a very difficult issue. It's coming off the tragic deaths of two toddlers last year that we all know too much about, I'm afraid, because it was such a horrific incident, both horrific incidents here in Vermont. But I think the struggles are evident in the legislation. But the bill that passed the Senate was mostly focused on what happens after the fact. It's a heavy focus on the criminal justice system, redefining crimes, making a felony in some cases when something goes wrong and somebody should have known.
Yes, there's a provision in the bill that would codify a new crime for somebody who's in a position to recognize when a child is being abused or neglected and fails to do so, fails to come forward and should have known. There is now a crime that's, that can be attached to that.
That's correct, and that's been the most controversial piece of it, and the House Human Services Committee is struggling with that. I happen to believe that would not be particularly helpful, particularly when the legislation has passed the Senate, does not deal with the number one issue that the various reviews pointed at, and that was staffing levels and the caseloads, the number of families each individual social worker has. You have to recognize that these are intense personal interactions. You can't be more efficient with better technology, although that would help in some cases. But you really need to have enough social workers to work with the families and see them often enough to understand what's going on in that family. All the reviews pointed to that, and yet I have heard no discussion out of the legislature about adding new positions. In fact, the caseloads right now for the workers at the DCF are actually higher than they were at this time last year when both of these deaths occurred.
And more staffers were added.
More staffers were added. Yes, the governor, with legislative support, added a number of positions last fall and after all of these reviews came out. But the fact is, we've seen a major increase in the number of children coming into custody. We've seen a major increase in the number of reports to DCF of suspected abuse and neglect, all of which require investigation. We've seen increasing drug abuse problems. I talk anecdotally with some of the workers there. They're pointing at the fact that drug abuse was involved, at least in one of the deaths last year. They're seeing an increase in the number of cases. So the fact, even though you have, in fact, added a number of workers, they aren't keeping up. And that's, I think the money is there. If it's a priority, it should be there. And I can be somewhat critical right now because I watch the legislature and they're finding money to clean up Lake Champlain, which is certainly a priority for us. They're finding money to deal with the cost shift on health insurance, and that's certainly important too. They're finding money for other priorities, job creation, all of which are important to Vermont. But where is the importance of children on the agenda there? And after this is a year old now, and perhaps it's fading from memory, but I hope they will focus on what did happen and why it happened, a variety of reasons. But if they aren't addressing the number one issue, I think they are failing Vermont's kids.
That's Doug Racine. He's the former secretary of the Agency of Human Services. He now works with the American Public Human Services Association in D.C., helping newly appointed human services CEOs. Doug, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And it's time now for your notes to the program. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me. Hello, Patty. Nice to talk with you.
Hi,
we're
Jane.
Swapping headphones here as we have Doug Racine sit quietly and watch us do our mailbag segment. Patty, go right ahead.
Jane, I want to take you back to last week when we hosted a discussion about the Armenian genocide. That was an event in which 1.5 million Armenians were killed by Ottoman Turks at the end of World War I. Those events occurred about 100 years ago, and the anniversary of that genocide will be commemorated later in April.
Yeah, and as Patty mentioned, we did a whole show on it, and we received several notes of appreciation for that program, including one from Dave in Waterville, who writes in part, "For the sake of the world, I hope we take the time to remember April 24th. I hope against hope that the Turkish government will express the leadership of offering an apology to the Armenian people and the world. It would lead to the United States and other world leaders reviewing our histories and apologizing for our atrocities. And we would commit ourselves to educating our peoples with these truths so that such atrocities may never occur again."
Jane, we also recently interviewed Middlebury College professor Murray Dry about his legal writing on the issue of same-sex marriage. And Dry argued in our interview with him that legalizing same-sex marriage should be done through the lawmaking process, through legislatures, rather than through the U.S. Supreme Court. And several listeners took exception to his argument.
Yeah, including Lori, who's also a professor at Middlebury College, and she writes, "I was really surprised you chose to air the very conservative and widely challenged point of views of my colleague Murray Dry. Dry's misunderstanding about the role of courts in creating equality in this country are hardly commonly accepted. According to Dry's argument, social justice has to be enacted through legislatures, not the courts. Overall, I was incredibly disappointed that you would allow his views to be aired and aired without other legal experts or marriage equality experts."
Well, yesterday's discussion of the behavior problems with fraternities brought in a lot of comments, among them this email from Chris. He writes, maybe the bigger conversation is that kids go to college these days more immature than ever. The 18-year-old of 100 years ago was more prepared to be an adult than nowadays. If fraternities were invented today, they would not be allowed. They would be seen as they are, exclusionary, elitist, predatory, and supported by a code of silence that is fueled by budding alcoholism.
When we discussed the effect of stress on the human body and how to manage it, Heidi in Montpelier emailed us to say, I was surprised that humor wasn't brought up. Neither was anything fun, playing with your dog, singing or playing music, or any kind of joy. Dance was mentioned only as a way to get required exercise. Sex? No mention. I appreciate your earnest approach to what appears to be almost a universal problem, but humor is also universal, and it's one of the best things in the world.
Well, we have an update that is fun on a story about Steve Daniels of South Burlington, no relation to me. He is the Vermont State pinball champion who is preparing to compete in the national championships in Las Vegas.
I'm really looking forward to it because it's Vegas and it's, you know, national championship. I'm not expecting really good things, but on the other hand, even if I get destroyed in my first round, I'm hoping that there's at least a good chance that I'll at least play my best.
And as it turns out, Steve didn't get destroyed at all. We have the results from Vegas, and he came in sixth. Congratulations, Pinball Wizard.
All right. Well, we love hearing all the comments we get from listeners, whether they're enthusiastic, critical, or suggestions for future discussions. Please get in touch with us. Email vermontedition@vpr.net.
All right. And that wraps up our program for today. Thanks, Patty. Tomorrow on the show, economics for conservationists. While it sounds like the two fields of study might never cross paths, a couple of UVM professors say otherwise. They've just published a field guide explaining the role of economics in the loss of natural lands and why conservationists should get up to speed. Join us for that conversation tomorrow at noon on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.